My name is Martin. I'm from a company in Sweden called Uclarity. We are advisors in the area between traditional telecommunication and IT communication. And my team is especially focusing on technical deployments. And although we're not a pure Microsoft shop or anything, what we do at the moment is very much focused on Link, of course, because it's a huge momentum of that. During the last years, we've done a lot of projects with customers with sites around the world, ranging from like 5 sites up to 1,000 sites. I've learned to be very humble when taking on these projects, because I know that in many cases, the project has started from a perspective that they wanted to lower the costs of telephony, for example. And then that means that when we are getting into this, we really need to find the balance between quality in what we want to deliver, the quantity of all the sites that needs to be done in time, and the cost for that. So although we would like to do a lot of very good things, just frankly, during the last years, we have done a lot of good things, and we have done a lot of things that might not be that good, and that's what I'm trying to share with you for these hours, with this hour and 15 minutes. So we'll spend quite a lot of time talking about what we've learned and also how to actually find this kind of pitfalls that we've been into or that we almost been into at least. And we will also do some technical stuff, of course, talking about the different deployment options and things like that. And this might not be the most technical session during the day, but we should still try to keep it on a 300 level. So nobody should be disappointed from that perspective, I hope. So what we learned is that every site that we come to is unique. And especially when we look at telephony in many different parts of the world, we see a lot of cultural differences in how we work with telephony. Different tools, different offers on the market from the carriers, different business models. And while all these sites have unique needs, I mean, many of these branch sites isn't like an average of your organization. It's just a fewer people, maybe. They have very different needs within that site. And if they are placed far from you, it's quite easy to be a bit quick on judging and just giving the minimal support to just give them up and running. But the problem is that the further you are from that site, the more unhappy they will be, because they probably already have this attitude at the site saying that the Big Brother rules everything and now they're taking our PBX away or something. So it's very important to be there and to try to be close with them and help them to be happy. Another thing that we learned is also that Link is very different, and I think that most of you also know that Link is very different from what people have seen before. So in many cases, it might be a bit hard to do a one-to-one kind of migration. And in the same way, it could be a perfect chance to do something better as well. So just be humble with that, and then we can actually do very good things within this project. Compared to many other centralization projects within the IT department, I think that branch site deployments and Link telephony might not be as cut and pasteable as many of the other projects that you've been running before. You just need to listen quite a lot to what the kind of different needs they have, because people work very differently with telephony in different parts of the world. So when we are running these projects, when starting up, we try to, on a quite early stage, do a site survey. During this site survey, we try to find some information about the sites Just basic information in the beginning, just to get a good understanding of the user base, what kinds of users they have in the site, what kind of profiles, number of users, and things like that. We try to find out as much as possible about the current solution, if they're running their own PBX, are they sharing with someone else maybe? Is it handled locally? Is it some kind of outsourced service? Just to give an understanding of how they buy this stuff. What kind of carrier contracts do they have? What carriers are they working with? And also especially information about contracts, when are contracts terminating and things like that. Because we build a roadmap when with working with different sites in a specific order, it's very important to take in consideration if our contract is expiring, for example, so we don't have to prolong something just because we didn't pay attention to that. When doing this kind of service, we also try not to ask too much things in the beginning. Because if it's in a large organization with many sites, you just won't get any answers. If you send out this survey and you don't, you go too detailed, people won't answer you. Because in many of the smaller sites, there's probably nobody that's really technical sitting there. They probably bought these things, they don't know too much. So don't ask for too much information in the beginning. When we start working with the site, we almost always start with a workshop, trying to find out what kind of specific needs they have, and then we can go to in much deeper details on that. When we learn about the organization, how the organization looks, what kind of IDs they are having, are they looking to cut expenses? Are they trying to centralize things? We try to build a blueprint that we will want to use as a template for this project. So this blueprint gives us a couple of different options. For example, if you have a site sitting close to the central site, maybe taking PSDN connectivity into the central site might be a better thing than having local equipment, for example. Just giving a couple of different ideas in this blueprint is a good thing for us to have as a template working on it. But we should also be aware that we might need to change our plans because every site is unique, as I said before. We can't do too many different kinds of things, but at the same time, we can't run over people either. So they need to be able to work the day after migration as well. So stepping back a bit and looking at the different deployment options that we have. One of the things that we are trying to take into consideration at the beginning is how to give the PSTN access to the site. Are we doing it centralized or are we doing local breakouts in the sites? So just going through these different options. When I say centralized PSTN access, I mean that we are taking the PSTN connectivity into the data center and the users there. My clicker needs me to be a bit closer. The users will get their telephony over the wide area network and connect through that. Giving these options gives a lot of savings maybe. It could be very easy to deploy, but at the same time, puts a big reliability on the, you need much more from the network. You might also run into some legal things. We'll come back to that in a couple of seconds. So local PSTN breakouts is when we are adding some kind of local equipment to the site. So getting a PRI or a SIP trunking service into that central site or that branch site, setting up some kind of survival branch appliances or whatever it could be. That's the two differences. So choose the path. So centralized PSTN access gives us the possibility to do quite easy piloting. So if we can get the numbers sent centrally, we can give people a few numbers without going in and changing too much stuff on the site. We can maybe start with giving people dialing conferencing functionalities, for example. And conferencing, dialing conferencing is a very good thing to do centralized because in many cases, the pool where all the conferencing is happening in the central site, so taking in telephony there might be a good thing. But there could be good or bad things for this. So if we have a carrier that can give us numbers from different regions or maybe different countries and send that to a central PSTN delivery, either it's a SIP trunk or something else, then we have a good chance to do this. In Europe, we have a couple of carriers that are able to deliver numbers through partners or through themselves to a central SIP trunk, and I think that one of our carriers can deliver numbers for about 48 countries or something, 50 countries, into a central place. That gives us a huge possibility to actually take all these small neighbors and do them centralized instead. But on the same time, these kind of carriers are often not the cheapest ones. So if you have a huge call volume, it might actually be expensive just because the charge per minute might be a bit higher than if you go with a local one. If you have very small volume of calls, it might save you quite a lot of money because you don't have to invest in local equipment and things like that. There can also be some kind of legal things that to consider here. It's not always an option because it might not be allowed to do in some countries and things like that. But in Europe especially, we have a couple of partners like do like that, and many of them actually are able to deliver numbers in US also, for example. So I think that these carriers can also help you with European numbers. Local PSTN access is always possible to produce in some way. We can always get a PRI in probably any country. We can get BRIs or analogs or SIP trunking services. So it's easy for us to drop to this one, but it might be a bit more expensive sometimes. So I'm going to talk a bit about the survivable branch concept and what it is and how it works. So how many of you are familiar with the concept of survival branch offices and survival branch appliances and things like that? Good few hands, all right. Everything in the area is not new for you, but I hope I can give you some details you might haven't considered before. So the idea with the survival branch architecture is that we put minimal link code and minimal link functionality in the branch site. Come back to exactly what it is. And that means that the clients use the local link server or the local link functionality as the SIP registrar. So clients will register against SPA. The SPA have minimal functions, and all the more advanced functionality as conferencing, response group services, the user database itself for all your buddies and your scheduled conferences is, for example, they're in the main site, in the central site. Voicemail from Exchange, for example, might be sitting there most probably as well. So we have minimal functionality here. That means that when the clients are connecting to the SPA or the SPS server, to that local link code, we still rely quite heavily on the wide area network to connect back to the data center. So if we are running conferences, for example, everything like that is hosted back in the data center. So one of the most important things to consider when we are looking at this module is that even though we are taking PSTN access into that site, so making phone calls in and out, for example, that will be done locally. As soon as you get into a conference, for example, that will rely on the data center. So if you have a huge latency because there's a huge distance, for example, between the site, the branch site and the central site, it might not be the best option for you. So you need to consider that. If you are using some kind of response group service for taking up like the main number and giving them some kind of IVR options, everything like that will go into the data center as well. So if you drop connectivity, you will lose that kind of functionality. So we can come back to that. For this kind of architecture, Microsoft built a concept called the Survival Branch Appliance that I think many of you have seen. And the Survival Branch Appliance is basically a chassis with two different components within it. One is the gateway component, the VoIP gateway, where all the magic things in converting whatever you take into a SIP dialect that my link can understand happens, and on the same time hosting these link code, the front-end service and the mediation service. Everything there is sitting on a Windows Server 2008 R2 box in the same chassis, actually. So there are a couple of different vendors doing this, and they have a couple of different ways of doing this. I'll come back to that a bit later. But basically, these two components can be totally independent on each other. Sometimes the gateway part runs on its own CPU, and it actually has some internal network connection connecting to that Windows server. So if one of them fails, the other one of them can still work, maybe. Some of these SPAs are built on a Windows server with actually just a card put into it and still needs some software to run on that Windows server. So there are a bit kind of differences in how they are built. So basically what happens when a call comes in, the call comes in from the carrier through the PRI or the BRIs or the analog lines or maybe over SIP. The VoIP gateway will do its magic when converting that to a SIP dialect that we can understand. An important thing to understand is that this doesn't have to be a PRI. It can definitely be SIP as well. So if you have a SIP trunking service from a carrier that doesn't have a certified SIP trunk, that gateway can do its magic to change it to a dialect that Link can understand. In some cases, we want to do other things as well. For example, faxes. You know, Link and faxes don't go too well together. Anybody experienced that? Okay. They doesn't work at all together. So taking in a fax, for example, if you have this kind of gateway, even though you're doing it over SIP, that gateway can break out the fax call before it hits Link, instead of trying to take it in within Link and do something with it, which won't work. That could be an idea of having it there. Or if you're getting at something else. Some of these gateways are modular, so you can change between PRI cards or BRIs or just SIP to SIP, which is basically, in most cases, just a licensing thing. So sending the call over to the mediation server in Link, the mediation server in Link will pass that to the front-end component, which will look up where the users are sitting and then send that call to the user. That's basically how the SPA works. If this is a call to a response group service or if it's a call to the dialing conferencing, that call will be sent to the central site where the conferencing component sits. If you take this part of the SPA that runs the Windows server and runs all these Link services and break them away, we call that the survival branch server. So the survival branch server is actually something that you can run on almost anything. These machines just have a place for a Windows server to run. So if you run that within your own data center on your own machine, you can hook up it against like a SIP trunking service or your own gateway or anything like that. So the SPS server is actually also a possibility if you don't go there, if you might have a gateway from a previous installation that actually could speak to Link in a way that it likes. Scalability-wise, the SPA is sized for the idea was to size it between 25 to 1,000 users or something like that, whereas the SPS server can be run on any hardware that you have, so it can probably scale a bit higher. So I think that one of the figures is up to 2,000 or something. But the most important thing to think about when you talk about all these figures and how many users it can support is that if you're running a lot of users here, they will still rely a lot on what's sitting in the data center. So if you do a lot of conferencing, you will have quite a lot of traffic happening over that link as well. There are a couple of vendors for the SPAs, and I think that most of them are here in the exhibition hall. The machine that I just showed you was AudioCodes. It could be a Sonos or a HP or a Ferrari or anything else. I just found a good picture when searching on it. So excuse me if there's anybody from Sonos here or something. Going back to the architecture and how this is supposed to work, talking a bit about site resiliency and what happens when things go bad, so to say. The idea with the Survivor Branch Appliance and the Survivor Branch Server is that the users should be able to get at least basic functionality from its telephony solution, even though some of the components fails. So what happens when a user starts up their clients in a good day when everything still works is that a SIP phone or a link phone edition will try to discover its SIP registrar, which is the Survivor Branch Appliance in this case, through DHCP. So it will send out a DHCP query, first, of course, for IP addresses, but also for two components within Link. And one is the SIP registrar, which in this case is the SPA or the SPS. And the other thing is the certificate service that gives us the certificate that we use to authenticate with. Link client running on a machine actually asks DNS instead, initially. So we try to find which server to speak to through DNS, through the service records and everything like that. So this is a bit of a simplified idea about how the login works. If you want to learn more about how the login process works for Link, then you can go to Brian Rick's session about the advanced client signing process. But what happens here is we find the registrar. The client, the first initial contact we have with our SIP registrar will actually be with the local SIP registrar trying to authenticate with the normal authentication methods. We will then be referred to the certificate issuer within Link that will give us a client certificate. I think I'll go with the keyboard instead. And the Link environment will give us a client certificate that's uploaded to the client sitting on the machine or sitting in the phone. This certificate is used for subsequent authentications. So one of the ideas is that if we lose connection to the data center, if we don't have any connection to any domain controllers or anything, we should still be able to authenticate against that SPA, and that's done with that certificate. These certificates are valid for 6 months. That's a period that we can extend or rather decrease if we want to. But the certificate is actually what we are authenticating us with. The idea with the SPA is that they should be able to be placed in a site that is so small that we wouldn't ever consider a domain controller. And as Link don't use the readable domain controllers, this is a good way of solving that authentication with a certificate instead. One thing that's very important to understand is that if we lose connectivity to the data center and our DHCP servers are sitting there, we won't get any IP addresses, right? So important thing is to make sure that the sites are self-containing for something. We need to have a DHCP server. We need to be able to give out IP addresses even though we have no connection to the data center, because otherwise we would fail. Some clients would probably work for a while while keeping their address, but if they are rebooted or something, or if they come in at work in the morning, they will try to get a new address and will fail. So we need a DHCP server. That DHCP server does not necessarily need to be the one that gives out all this information that we spoke about before, about SIP registrars and things like that. If we don't do that with our ordinary DHCP servers, the SIP registrar can actually give us that kind of information itself. So each SPA or each SPS has its own DHCP server, which actually is true for the central site as well, which we can use to give out this kind of information. So that's a feature that can be turned on and off. When we use the front-end servers as a DHCP server, it will just give out the options that we need to provide the client with the right service. We don't give out IP addresses or create any crazy things like that. Same thing with DNS. If we don't have a DNS in an outage, for example, the clients sitting on the PC will actually fail back and do the DHCP discovery instead, and try to find its way here. So what happens when things go bad? For example, if we have a failure of our wide area network, what happens then? if the network goes down and the site becomes isolated, the clients will go into something that we call resiliency mode. Resiliency mode will show the clients a red banner saying that we have limited usage. If you have a phone, it will be shown in the display as well. And this means that we lost connection to the backend. So in this case, we don't have any conferences. We don't have any response groups. We don't have any dialing conferencing or things like that. At least nothing that we can participate in here at the moment. But we still have possibilities to do dial in and dial out basic telephony. Voicemail, for example, could actually be solved by some rerouting over PSTN in some cases if the data center is up and functional. But the client here is isolated as long as it sits on its own network. So if you are relying on response groups, for example, they are eliminated here. It's important to understand that. Other things that might go wrong, of course, is that if the SBA or the SBS fails, that will also have an impact. Clients that are normally connecting to the SBA learned through their first logon that they have something called the backup registrar. The backup registrar means that if the primary registrar goes down, we'll register against that one instead. So in this case, the client will actually go back and register with the data center, or pointing in the wrong direction, will register with its ordinary pool. And the good thing here is that as our home pool, or our backup registrar in this case, keeps the user database, it won't actually give us any resiliency mode or limited functionality. We have full functionality within this mode, except for one thing. Calls are not coming in, of course. But outbound calls might work. As long as these users are assigned with policies that allows them to send out calls, they will be able to dial out maybe through the central site's PSTN connectivity. Depending a bit about rules on how the SIP trunks or the PSTN connection to the central site work, we might strip off your DDI. We might not show that in some cases. We might need to go in and configure so we are allowed to dial out even though we are trying to display some other kind of numbers. But this is absolutely possible to configure to make it able to dial out. And if we have a good carrier that can help us, he might actually be able to help us and reroute that incoming traffic to the central site instead. So we have a customer with a branch site in here in US. The main site is in Europe, and they have a branch site in Florida. And we have a local SIP trunking coming into that facility. And the cool thing is that if we bring down the local SBA there for some reason or something happens and people living in Florida knows that sometimes everything in infrastructure doesn't work, then we actually send that traffic to our SIP trunk in Sweden in this case instead. So the only difference for them is that the calls are coming another way. They are taking over our own MPLS network, which adds some kind of latency and things like that, but we still have full functionality, which is pretty cool. So this is something that you need to work with your carrier to solve. And it might be a bit hard if you have different carriers in different parts of the world, of course. And in most cases, most carriers say they are globally. They probably have the same logo. They probably have the similar looking website, but they are very, very local. So it's not always possible to solve these things. But some carriers can do that, and that's pretty awesome when it works. Another thing that can happen as well is if we have a SBA, for example, and that SBA is built on these two components, as I spoke about before, like where we have a VoIP gateway that is very independent of the Windows server running the SBA or the front-end servers on the mediation server. If one of these components fails, doesn't necessarily mean that it brings down the other one. So for example, if we have a failure where the Windows server sitting on that SBA breaks, but the gateway component is still working, we might actually have a quite good situation here as well. Because if we are able to re-register the clients, which will happen automatically in the same way as we did in the last scenario, the central site could actually be configured to work against these gateway components sitting in the branch site as well. So we just might have a bit of different media flows in this scenario. And this is, of course, a bit depending on the architecture of the SBA. So I like the architecture when the gateway component is very independent from the Windows server running on the same machine. I like this architecture. All vendors don't do it that way, but still, if, for example, the link code fails in some way and the gateway component is up and working, we can have a quite good, a decent situation anyway. There are a couple of things more that we need to know when it comes to resiliency of SBAs. One of the major things that I said is if we are running the SBA and we lose connection to the central site, things like response group will fail, for example. One other thing when planning your infrastructure is that Link 2013 implements or brings in this fabulous concept of pool pairing. Have you heard of that? So pool pairing, where you can actually have either two enterprise pools or two front and standard edition servers pairing each other. If one pool fails, the other pool can take over. There are some manual steps to do this. The problem with this architecture is that the branch appliances or the SBA or the SPS concept doesn't work with pool pairing. So if your pool in the central side fails, if you have a SBA connected to that one, you need to go in and repoint that SBA manually to work to the other one. So it's a bit more complex. And if you have a lot of SBAs, that might be something to consider as well. So don't just count on the pool pairing to work for this scenario. If we're going to the other architecture that I spoke about, the central site, what happens if we lose connection to the central site? In case, for example, that the wide area network fails and the branch becomes isolated, one of the good things with Link is that if we move the clients externally, for example, if we put them on the internet, we send them home, we give them a 4G router, or we get a secondary internet connection or something. If we have a working edge infrastructure, the clients can actually connect that way instead and connect to the data center. They will have full functionality. If you have mobile devices like Link Mobile and have a decent network connection, maybe that could be a working solution for you instead. So one of the things that I want to bring out is I don't say that I don't like the SBA or SBA concept, because it's fantastic in some ways. But considering the central site option, in many cases, can actually give us better functionality when it comes to resiliency. Because if we have a working connection and we can put more money into building this one, very, very stable, we will still have all the functionality, because this is where the response groups are sitting, or this is where our contact center application probably resides, and things like that. So going back to the project where we are bringing Link to the branch users, one of the things that I think is extremely important is to be very thorough when doing your planning and discovery. So everything that we fail with here, everything that we, for example, take for granted or everything that we cheat with here, it will bite us quite soon when we launch. Because when telephony doesn't work the way it should, people will tell us quite fast. So do your homework. Ask several times. I'll come back to that a bit later. But we generally, when we start planning for a site migration, we run a workshop. So during this workshop, we try to get as much information as possible. So we want to know what the requirements do they have, what kind of users do they have, are they running some kind of advanced functions for a contact center, for example, are they having some kind of IVR functionality or anything for call distribution. We need to know that. And the problem is that many deployments that we've seen, we really don't have a good speaking partner. Because in many of the small sites, there might be some kind of IT administrator. And he, in most cases, I shouldn't say, in many cases, these guys are very familiar with everything when it comes to how the PCs works and how all that services works. But when it comes to telephony, in many cases, that PBX was put in there many, many years ago, and nobody really knows how it works. And the users don't really know that either, because they take everything for granted. So if they have some kind of group numbers and things like that, it's sometimes very hard to find someone who can really say what's in there. So we need to dig deep if we can. So find out all these requirements. We want to know a lot about the current solution. And this is where we go into a bit more detail, finding out, for example, what kind of PSTN connectivity do they have? What kind of capacity? Are they doing BRIs, for example? How many? Are they doing PRIs? What kind of wide area network connection do we have, and how much load is it on that one? We would like, if possible, to actually go in and do a network assessment every time we do a rollout. We try to sell that at least. We want to know how much bandwidth we can spend for link. Because even if we are putting out SBAs or if you do it centrally, some kind of traffic will happen over the wide area network. Finding out things about like Wi-Fi networks in the site. Many of the smaller sites have very simple Wi-Fi deployments, and they have probably worked fine for like surfing or checking email in the conference room. But when we are adding phone capabilities to that, I'm not sure it will work as good. We're also going in and do quite a lot of migration planning. So we try to get as much information as possible, and we try to ask more than just the technical side admin. Try to talk to some of the people, maybe people responsible for sales or order or support or whatever is happening at that site, and speak to them and see how things should work. And generally, we try to ask each question several times. And if we get different answers, we ask them again. Because if we get different answers, then we know that nobody's really sure about how it works. So we really need to go in and dig deep here. After that, we need to go in and try to build our own design for that site. And this is where we need to balance between this quality thing and the capacity thing and the pricing thing. Because if we have 10 sites, for example, we can probably spend quite a lot of time doing these things. If we have 1,000 sites and we have a roadmap that we are rolling out one site every week or something, of course we need to cut somewhere to be able to do that. But extremely important when we deal with international sites is that it's a bit hard to say that, okay, we did one site in London, for example, and then we are doing something in Beijing the week after that, and we give them the same solution. That probably won't work. So we need to take that, especially considerations when we're dealing with international sites. So one of the first things is that we need to understand how they work with telephony, and one of the things is, for example, number planning, what kind of number series do we have, dialing habits and things like that. And one tool that I find very helpful is MVP fellow Ken. He made this link dialing rule optimizer. Have you seen it? It will help you build normalization rules. And the good thing with this one, it can help. He actually put in a huge amount of work to try to see how numbers should look in different countries. So it's very, very helpful. There are a couple of things that we might need to add to that. I generally try to learn as much as possible about how number planning and how numbers look in each country by going to Wikipedia, for example. Using these tools. I also try to ask friends. If I have friends living in that country, if I have fellow MVPs or something, I just try to talk to them and see what needs to be in there. Because there are a huge different things. In Germany, for example, that's quite common. They have a variable length in numbers. In other countries, they're all the same. Some countries have a huge amount of area codes. Some countries have totally skipped area codes and doesn't have anything to differ between different regions or cell phone numbers or anything. So we need to find out these kinds of things. This is a good way to do that. Another thing that we need to find out is what kind of cultural differences are there within the country. So I've been working with sites both in US and Europe and Scandinavia and Asia, and I've learned a lot, because in the beginning I thought that everything works like it do in Sweden, of course. And it doesn't. And I have learned that Scandinavia and Sweden is very different. But just take an example between Europe and US, for example. How much people here from Europe? Good. Okay. So in US, you love voicemail, right? You build your own business based on voicemail. Oh, it's a joke that we have. In US, it's very easy to put all unanswered calls to a voicemail. People are sitting in a queue for a while, send it to voicemail. If you probably use a personal voicemail all the time. In Europe, many companies don't even want voicemail. They say we want it to be sent to some, because we want to give a more personal touch. We want them to speak to someone else who can take that message. Anybody recognize that? Okay, I actually think that sucks. That's one of the things with the US thing that I like better, because sending it to someone else is just a manual voicemail. And in most cases, when I come to a voicemail or I come to someone else, I hear a voice that I don't recognize, I just hang up. Because if I leave a voicemail, then I leave the task to dial back to someone else. And they will probably try to call me back during a time where I don't have time to do that. So I rather hunt myself when I have the time for that. So, okay. So voicemail is one huge difference. But the thing is with Link is that the Link is very depending on voicemail. Because we don't have any busy tone, voicemail is quite important. Because if we don't answer, either because we're not there or because we're busy, people will think we are quite ignorant. So voicemail is always a chance for someone to leave something there. Then it's, of course, important for us to go actually in and check that voicemail and call back. That's something else. Another thing, in many parts of Northern Europe, for example, cell phones have replaced desktop phones totally. So in Sweden, Norway, many parts of Finland as well, people don't actually use desktop phones at all. So the only desktop phones that we roll out in projects are conference rooms. So people are given cell phones instead. So many of the PBXs have something called mobile extension, which means that the desktop has been replaced with a phone, and maybe with an iPhone. And if people if the company has replaced the desktop phone with an iPhone, it's quite hard for us to come in and say that we are collecting all these iPhones and we are giving you a headset and you're supposed to call from the PC instead. Nobody would like that. So in this part of the world, we actually need to build something else. Then in that case, we need to build Link and make Link add value to that cell phone. I wouldn't say that the cell phone is the perfect solution for anything, because voice quality and everything, it's quite isolated. But when we tie them together, it's pretty cool. So in Norway, for example, it's quite common that we are implementing a functionality called mobile line status, which means that we are actually checking the cell network for if the line is occupied. So if someone is on a cell call, we will propagate that as presence down to Link and push that out to the organization, which is pretty cool, because if you are walking on town, you will be read even though you're not logged into your PC, which is pretty cool. So we need to find these things, because if we just have a our way of seeing it, there's a big chance that people won't be very happy with us. So that's what I mean with cultural differences. It's also important to understand that there are very different markets when it comes to carriers, for example. So if you are speaking to a carrier in one country, they probably have a business model that you need to understand when speaking to them. Not all carriers are like Bitpipes just selling you PSTN minutes. Many of them want to sell you other services as well. And if you don't understand that, it might be a bit hard to actually buy something that you want. And it's actually a bit hard as well for a company with many international sites to find a carrier that can help you throughout the world, even though some carriers say that we are international, we can give you access in all these countries. In many cases, that are some kind of partnerships going on under the hood that you don't probably know about too much in the beginning, but you will learn during the project because there are so many different things with it. So there are different offerings, different business models, and different namings. Just the thing like in the US, for example, if you buy a PRI, you will most probably buy it as a T1, right? In Europe, it's often sold as an E1, but in France, they call an E1 a T2, and just buying equipment for that and understanding all the things, then it's good to have friends and Bing. Then we all have all these legal requirements to consider as well. There are a lot of laws and regulations that we need to consider when we are going out on our world tour with Link. If we don't want to end up in jail or get sued afterwards. But knowing rules about, for example, toll bypass, are you allowed to do local breakouts? It's like sending your calls from Sweden out in India, for example, or taking in calls in US for someone sitting in China. It's important to understand what kind of rules there is for this. 911 or 112 is in Europe. How should that be treated? I know some states here has very specific rules about how that should work. Europe are changing the rules as well in regard to this. So many laws are quite new here. So we need to understand what we need to deliver. So many of this very nice functionality that Link has with enhanced 911, for example, that you can use here in US with some of the partners downstairs in the exhibition, doesn't exist in many other parts of the world. So in Europe, for example, you often have to go in and send the 112, for example, and then you need to go in and identify the city with a prefix or a suffix or both of them. And that differs between countries and carriers and things like that. So find out all these things could be a bit work as well. There could be laws about emergency phones as well. You might need to have analog lines for certain things. And it's important to understand that many of the things that we hear here might not be the law. It might just be recommendations as well. So don't take everything for true just because someone says it. So we really need to check to see what is a law and what is not, and how do we cope with that. So then we have a lot of other stuff. Link is a fantastic tool for many things, but we have a legacy that we need to take care of as well. So if we come to this site where they had a very old PBX, for example, it's been sitting there for years, nobody knows what it is. You need to be a detective to see what's in there, because people will take everything that works today for granted. So there are a lot of other things that we need to think about. So faxes, for example, it's a kind of a pain point as I see it, because Link doesn't handle fax. The problem is then if we have a number range of like 100 numbers and the fax number is just in the middle of this one, we need to do something with it. Either we maybe take a gateway, we can pick that call to that number and break it out somewhere. If we are trying to port this number range to SIP trunks far, far away, then it could be a bit of a problem to have 100 numbers minus one being ported, because the carrier don't want to do that. They don't want to break up the number series when porting. Analog phones are quite easy to handle. There are good small gateways that we can get that's quite cheap to do analog phones. So that's not very complex, but we need to act with them. DECT and Wi-Fi handsets. Some of the vendors are integrating fine with Link, so you might just have to look at software upgrades. Others might need gateway components. So Audio Codes, for example, have a fantastic product called SIP phone support that saved me a couple of times that can actually go in and take other SIP-based phones and make them actually speak to Link through this gateway, for example. Door phones. That's a quite funny story, because we've been asking about door phones in so many of our projects. And when we do this in the beginning, nobody says, oh, there's no door phone, you don't have to care about that. But when we come there, there's always a door phone. So bringing one of these small analog gateways in the bag, just to be safe, could be a good idea. So I'll talk about my toolbox a bit later. Alarm systems, posters, and credit card machines. In many cases, they are just dialing out, so it's not very complex, but they might need an analog port to dial out. The problem with these things is that you need to be able to test it. So how do you test the alarm system and make sure that it works? How do you test to see if that credit card machine really reports things, or the postage machine, which probably just sends information once in a month or something? If you left them and it tried to send that report later on, it would probably break. And I run into problems when I don't speak French. So I was in France, and I got this credit card machine that I just need to verify if I got it to work. I have no clue, because it was French coming out from the machine, of course. And in the middle of the night, just finding someone who can verify that it works, because the store opens tomorrow, it could be a bit hard sometimes as well. So it's important to have a good understanding what's in there, and how do we verify that things actually work. And then we come into the migration, where we are actually shifting to the new solution. How are we going to do that? Are we doing the Big Bang or a side-by-side? So Big Bang, in my case, it means, are we shifting the whole telephony solution from one night to another, or are we doing it at time over time? So for example, if we have a large site with a lot of users, and we might not be able to move all the users, then we can actually go in and connect the existing infrastructure in some way to link. So for example, putting in SPA, for example. The old PBX can set up a trunk to the SPA, and we can have calls coming in through that old solution. The problem is that we need to go back sometimes, and there's a lot of administration going on here. But the good thing is that if we have a huge amount of users, we can be pretty sure that when we are starting to migrate, we're not able to do in number by number. We will get department by department, and they will be split. So in this case, it will probably be quite easy to go into the old solution and actually pick that users. But in the end, it could be complex, it could be expensive, because it's not sure that everything works. We might need to buy additional gateways sometimes, or licenses. So if we don't have to do this, it might be a good idea to do it a bit more aggressive, and do everyone at once. Okay, this is actually another solution. So another way of doing it could be to get a new PSTN connection. So for example, if we have a PRI pointing to the old PBX, we can maybe get a new PRI, or maybe a SIP trunking service or something, working to our SPA or SPS. The thing that we have to consider there is probably porting. So then we need to speak to the carrier and ask them to move certain numbers. And how many of you guys have been working with porting numbers sometime in your life? How many times has that worked perfectly on the first attempt? Can anybody say, okay, I accidentally say once, but can anybody say beat that and say two? Okay, maybe some. Okay, probably done many of these then. Because things like that failed. And one of the most fantastic things is that if you ask the carrier to port from a range of 1,000 numbers, and you ask them to port certain numbers, they say that it's not possible to do that. You can just port like hundreds or all of them. But when you do that porting, you can be damn sure that they port 55 numbers out of 100. So they can, in some way, do this selective porting anyway. So porting can be extremely... just don't rely on everything working at the same time. Just plan for that, and then you're probably good. Okay, a lot of emotions when it comes to porting. The other thing is to do just a shift of night. So in some cases, we go in and put up a SPA, for example, and just over one night, we just unplug the cable and move it to the other one. So that's a real big bang, everything happening at one night. And if it's a small site, it might be a bit easier to actually do that. From a cost perspective, it's probably cheaper. You will have to staff up with support personnel and everything like that, of course. but it might be easier. But on the same time, in many cases, you can't even do that because you need to go slow because of training and other dependencies and things like that. And then, of course, we have the possibility to go central. And we've done that quite a few times now where we're actually taking away local equipment and local PSTN connections and porting in the numbers to that central, in this case, central SIP trunking service instead, and bringing them in here. It's still porting and everything that comes with that. But that, of course, is also an option. Okay, so finally, some things that we learned on our trip and during all our projects, some success and factors for success and failures. First thing, let's come to hard technical things. Testing your network might be a very important thing because a lot of networks today are built for pure data traffic and people haven't thought about what real-time applications such as Link really does with a network. So testing a network is a good thing. There are several different ways to do that, and you can do it on different ambitions. We have a tool ourselves that we use where we are putting out probes on the network that generates traffic, and we go in and we measure and see what kind of latencies we have, packet loss, jitter values, and things like that. Also try to see what kind of utilization there is on these lines. Do we have to add more capacity, for example? So, for example, if you are going for a centralized solution and all your telephony traffic will go to the central side over that bond connection, it's very important to see, do you really have room for that? Some cases we might need to go in and upgrade that connection, and just the cost of the upgrade can then sometimes be more expensive than doing this local implementation anyway. The problem is that the local implementation in the architecture that we have still relies a bit on the bond connection. And that's not a bad thing, it's just a natural thing because that's how Link works. We should collaborate more with each other. So we will be more depending on that. But test your network. I would say that's a really important thing for success. Because when you do a migration from one solution that's been sitting for 15 years then go to a new one, I would bet that how dissatisfied they've been with that solution, no solution works as good as it did when you were leaving it, right? So it's important because the users won't understand if they get bad audio quality just because we are using that network and the networking guys didn't do their homework. That would beat us. So test your network is very important. And do not underestimate traffic prioritization. And I know that someone at Microsoft said in the beginning of Office Communication Server era that we don't need quality of service because we have quality experience. Okay? You heard that? Okay? And it might be true sometimes. The idea behind that was that we have a very a codec that is very adaptive and it's you can beat it quite a lot with bad networks, but the problem is that you will put a higher load on the network and you will need more resources and more bandwidth in the end. And the problem is that sometimes you're not able to actually go to the carrier and say, yeah, that we need more bandwidth. It might be very expensive, but we actually had discussions. It was a couple of years ago. We had a discussion with a carrier in a country and said that we want this 10 meg connection. We can cost how much it would be. And they say, I'm sorry, you just need to understand that we just have 50 megabits into the country. You just can't buy how much you want. So prioritizing traffic is an important thing. And I know that there's a lot of sessions today and tomorrow about traffic prioritization. And the quality of service might not be the most fantastic solution and bring your own concepts and mobile devices and everything will beat traditional quality of service in the long run. But still, today it's what we have, and I think it's very important to go in and do that. Another thing that's important as well is to have a very good test protocol to know what to test. So before you start this project, have a very good idea of what you are about to test. Because if you are doing a migration and you know you're going live tomorrow at 7 o'clock when the thing's opening, and you're sitting in 5 in the morning finalizing the last things and doing some changes, it's very hard to miss something. So if you have a test protocol, maybe not that extensive, but at least gives some basic test that covers quite a lot, it's very valuable to have that early in the morning before people are coming to work. Build your toolbox is something else that I talked about. When I go, I try to have a couple of tools with me, and some of the tools could, of course, be Ken's dialing optimizer and things like that. But more physical things, I wasn't kidding about that, but I actually have a small analog gateway in my bag. Sometimes I might need to leave that one and order a new one or something, but it's very good to have, because if you come to a site and there is something that you need to connect, if you don't have spare ports or things like that, you still want to do that. I always have an analog phone in my bag as well, just to be able to test things if I don't understand if the postage machine is actually sending something. So can I still dial out? I try to buy SIM cards when I come, so I'll be able to see if number presentation works the way it should. Because if you're just trying dialing out to one cell phone, dialing to your own, and your is, in my case, is Swedish, and I'm sitting in Germany, numbers might be presented another way when you do this. So local SIM cards is very good to have, especially when you are working with countries where this simultaneous ringing thing is a central part, for example. Other success factor: don't trust the site admin to be 100% correct. I think I was talking about this before. Two things. In many cases, they might not know exactly how it works, but they might answer you anyway. In some cases, they might not even be your friend. And that happens as well. And you're laughing. I wasn't. So gather information from more people. Because if you're working in support, you don't know how the person in order department or in sales or in support really works. So ask more of them. It doesn't have to be a one-day interview or anything, but just speak to them and see how they think things work. And once again, ask every question 5 times. If you are getting different answers every time you're asking them, then there's something rotten and you need to dig deeper. Don't underestimate user training. We have had a lot of chaos in the morning when people don't know how to answer the phones and don't know where the call is actually coming in and what is this headset and how am I supposed to put it on and things like that. I think it's very important to curl for the users. Help them connect the devices and make sure, don't just put out boxes there. People coming in on Monday morning don't open the box, but they will eventually see that the computer is ringing in some way. So make sure that to help them and work with user training, especially if these people are working in order departments or things like that are taking a lot of calls. Make sure that they know how to do. And I don't think that all users need the same kind of training. In some cases, you might need to train them in how to take a call, how to connect a call, and things like that. Other users might find that themselves. They might just need to have inspiration and understand how they should work. Because the people that had learned to work with Link is very happy, as you know. So just help them understand. Feel the heat is something that I also always try to get into my project. I want to be on site as much as possible when we go live, especially with the larger sites. I want to hear what people are saying. I want to hear this, because if I'm sitting on the other side of the world and I don't hear anything, it could be totally chaos. Don't have time to report to me, or I don't get the correct information so I can do the changes, or everything might be perfect as well. But to be where it happens, I think that's a very important thing. So just feel the heat is something that we try to do. It's not always possible to do that. In some projects, we have been so aggressive in pushing out site per site, so there is actually nobody there. But it is a risk when you do that. I think it's important. And after the projects, don't leave them by themselves. Check back with them and see if they're happy, if things work as it should. How's audio quality? Are people getting familiar to work with it? Have a dialogue, have feedback. Get the feedback by contacting them. Schedule meetings, for example, for the next couple of months or at least weeks. Because we actually had projects where we thought things gone quite good, and just because the feedback was not coming in, they appeared to be very unhappy with the solution, and then everything is just would become chaos. And then sometimes it could be political things within that organization, the branch versus the headquarters, and the local IT versus central IT. Might not. You need to be the bridge between them and be on all the places and speak to everybody and make sure people are happy. I think that's important. And last things, what I'm coming from the Nordic countries without too much color, wear sunscreen in some places. But that's all I had. So actually a couple of minutes early than I expected. Thanks a lot for your time. And let's bring up all the questions. Pardon, okay. I'll try to repeat the question. So if the client learned about the local SPA when it started up, or when it asked the DHCP to get information about the local SPA, how does it know that it should connect to the data center if the SPA breaks down? Okay. It's called the backup registrar. So when you are doing a successful registration, which is key to this, the first time you log in, you get some information. And one of the things that you get a certificate, for example. But one of the things you get is actually the name of your backup registrar. So if your client tries to reach the SPA that failed, and it doesn't answer, it will, after 120 seconds, go in and try the backup registrar instead, which is the central pool in the case of SPA. So it will connect there. That's cached information, yeah. Then it doesn't work. Pardon? To have the, sorry, can you repeat that? If you would have get that information somewhere else, it will go there. I'm not sure that the value, even though you can put in the value in the DHCP response, I'm not sure if it would actually take that. But technically, absolutely, if you can go in and change that value, for example, if you have the DHCP server, it's not sitting on the SPA, it's sitting on the DHCP server. If you go in and change it there, yeah, it will go there because it can connect to any pool. And it will try to redirect you. But the problem is that if it's the first registration, it will probably try to redirect you there anyway. So generally, there are other things as well. For example, the certificate thing that you get for authentication is also something that you get during the first registration. So I think that if it's the first time, I think you might need to change that one to register to against the first pool. You can probably do a lot of things to make it work, but the easiest thing is probably just to home in on the central site and let them sign in there. When you solve it, move it. But the solution is not built for being down for months or anything. Then you still need to rehome your users and do anything else with them. So. Sorry. No, because when the SPA goes down and the user registers against the central pool instead, They will just see that they are disconnected and they can connect back again. So they don't have any limited functionality because everything is relying on the pool. So they don't do that. There will be different media paths and things like that, but they don't get notified of that. So the only way is when you lose the connection to your backend information, which is on the central pool.
What about an active call in that scenario?
That's a good question. The question was, if you have a partial SPA failure where the SPA code goes down, if the gateway breaks down, of course it will fail. But if you have a peer-to-peer call, for example, that will keep on. You will not be able to add video or sharing or anything like that. But the call should actually absolutely still flow even though your register is down. I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen that, but if you try that sometimes, if you have a lab environment and just take down your front-end server, the call will survive. So it's quite nice. But there are scenarios when it comes to these partial failures, depending on if your gateway, for example, are communicating with the mediation server on that local SPA, and that goes down, that will break the call. If you have media bypass, then you might survive just that particular call. But in general, I mean, if you have these major failures, that means some kind of reconnection, and things, you should expect that. Yeah. Absolutely. Sorry.
So the question is, when the backend pool goes down, you have a message for you to avoid that in case of a maintenance window or something. You say, I can pay over that SPA to the secondary pool?
Do you mean that you want to take your users?
Like, I have my user registered, my SPA.
Yeah.
My pool will be off for 6 hours.
You can move around users, but at the same time, SPA is always paired with one pool. So yeah. So if you have your users registering against that SPA, that user is actually homed on that SPA. So if you want to do maintenance of the pool, moving the user, you will not move the user from that pool to you will actually move them from the SPA to the other pool. So I know that many IT departments try to do the build the infrastructure to be able to do all kind of maintenance during business hours and things like that. And Lync might not be that kind of application. For taking Exchange, for example, you have this client access layer and you have the mailbox layer and Outlook is running in cached mode. So if you lose connection to the backend, they will still experience the same things. They build that good, but when you're talking about real-time communication as Lync, it's a bit hard. I mean, having a meeting, for example, if you take that host meeting down, that will break that meeting, even though you're able to reconnect and you can start somewhere else. Real-time communication is harder to do that with. And Lync is might not be the best product for centralization, not because the product has any lacks or anything. It's more that if you have a user in US and you have users in Asia, for example, if they are running meetings on the same pool, there'll be huge latencies and things like that. So, I mean, the speed of lightning is more limiting for Lync centralization than anything else. The question was if the failover things for Lync Phone Edition are the same as the qualified phone, like the SNOMs and everything like that. I can't answer that 100% correct, and I think that could be quite individual for how they work. I don't think that there's a specification for the qualified program that specifies exactly how that should work. So I'm pretty sure that the Polycoms, for example, and the SNOMs work differently in these scenarios. So one of the challenges with blending a lot of different things is that you need to know how they work. I know for sure how it works with the Lync Phone Edition, and that I love these devices, and I'm a bit sad that they're saying that they're going away.
You mentioned the S2 that generates traffic.
Hmm? Okay, there are several tools on the market, and we use a tool from a company called Apnera. There's a vendor downstairs, it's called Ixia, that makes a fabulous tool as well. Ixia, they're down on the exhibition floor. So go speak with them, because they are here. That's a fantastic tool as well. There are others, but there's some freeware that you can run on some kind of open source OS that can generate these things as well. A good thing when doing these tests is, if you are running software sitting on a regular machine, for example, if you're putting these kind of probes or network traffic generators on a standard PC, for example, you have a lot of other things happening on that machine that can interfere with that traffic. So the appliances are quite good. But in the same way, the appliances, if you want to try wireless networks, for example, that's a bit more advanced than doing wired. If you're doing wireless networks, installing software on a PC might be easier, because that can probably go in and authenticate with like 802.1x, for example, whereas the network probes can be quite hard to go to the network guys and say, that can we fix this in on the network? Getting them wired is in most cases doable, but getting on the wireless is a bit harder. So wireless is a bit harder to test than wired. Okay, you mean standard edition server?
Yeah.
The difference is architecture between these two. The standard edition server is a full pool. It has everything, conferencing and everything like that. So it's absolutely an alternative in some sites to put them in the site. The problem with them is that they're harder to pair them with something else, because you can do pool pairing with standard edition servers, but you're not able to do pool pairing. For example, if you put one standard edition server in one site, if you're pairing that with a central site's pool, it will be like a two-way pairing thing. And then you also need to be prepared. If the central site fails, all these users will come down there as well. So it's not perfect for that.
The AVMCU is locally.
The AVMCU is locally on the standard edition server. So you need to, so from a redundant perspective, from a resiliency perspective, the standard edition server is not meant to be placed in these sites, so they have some drawbacks. But if you think that you have a kick-ass data center and you are the guy that can take care of it, putting a standard edition server in the site is absolutely a good option sometimes. And we've done that, because in many cases you need that. If you have a huge distance, for example, if you have users sitting in the somewhere in far, far away in Asia, and you have your data center sitting somewhere in Western Europe, just doing the conferences can be painful as well. So then that could be a case. But you need to consider the resilience of things. In our case, we couldn't pair it. We've done standard edition servers in other sites as well. But we can't do the pairing thing because we don't have a good partner to pair it with. And should maybe be have one in Japan and one in China and pair them maybe, but that then network design comes into consideration as well. So.
But if you had a separate
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So if you had five,
yeah, just you can definitely do that. Yeah, you can have like dedicated pairs for the central site to your data center. The only thing that it will drive the cost, because then you will pay for the standard edition, the SPAs are good from a licensing perspective, because it's the front end service in the central pool that you pay for. If you're doing the standard edition servers, one in the site and one just for that site in the data center, it will cost you a server license. And there's no difference between standard edition or enterprise editions anymore. It's just one standard server, so it will cost you. If you
I
answer the right question, because I'm being recorded here, so I need to be. If you have five sites, for example, and you say that each site has its own standard edition server, it would be possible to put one standard edition server corresponding each site. in the data center, if that's what you mean.
But
exactly, that would be 10. So it drives the cost. It couldn't be 5 to 1, unfortunately. SPSs is one thing. No, standard edition service, the full service. So for the SPSs or SPAs, then you can have several. So absolutely, then just it's a different model for this. So I'm going to just say thank you for everybody that came here. So you don't have to be polite and wait. I know that most of your friends wasn't polite, but I'll stay here and I'll take as many questions as I can. So just go on.